KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The U.S. wants rare earth minerals mined in Ukraine, but Ukraine wants future security guarantees in exchange. Can President Zelensky convince President Trump to add that to the deal today? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Panama is a country that migrants used to traverse south to north on their way to the U.S. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Now people are headed in the other direction. NPR correspondent Ada Peralta brings us a view from the ground in Panama. Also, the U.S. Supreme Court gears up for two cases examining the extent of presidential powers. And strapping yourself to a rocket-propelled sled seems dangerous, but what if it's for science? It is Friday, February 28th. Make room, Melania. Another Slovenian has risen to the spotlight in America. The Los Angeles Lakers' Luka Doncic turns 26 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump meets Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the White House today. They're supposed to sign a preliminary deal that shares Ukrainian critical minerals with the U.S. Trump insists this is an important step toward reaching a peace deal with Russia. He has been wanting it in recompense for U.S. aid to Ukraine.
The American taxpayers will now effectively be reimbursed for the money and hundreds of billions of dollars poured into helping Ukraine defend itself, which by and of itself is a very worthy thing to do. We've paid far more than any other country.
But Ukraine's president has also insisted on U.S. security guarantees in order to bring an end to Russia's invasion of his country. In the U.S., a federal judge in California says the Trump administration's mass firings of probationary federal workers is likely illegal and must be halted. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports the judge ordered the Office of Personnel Management to rescind some of its directives to terminate federal workers.
Several labor unions and civic organizations sued the Trump administration, saying its Office of Personnel Management had violated the law by ordering agencies to fire probationary employees en masse. In court, the government argued that it was merely an ask, not an order. U.S. District Judge William Alsup rejected that argument, noting that the firings happened suddenly and across so much of the government. Because of standing issues, he issued only partial relief to those agencies whose firings affect the civic groups that joined the lawsuit. They include the VA, the Small Business Administration, the National Park Service, the National Science Foundation, and others. He scheduled another hearing in 2 weeks. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The U.S. Education Department has launched a new website called End DEI. The public can file complaints there about diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in public schools. The federal agency says it will use this tool to find areas for investigation. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a slowdown in inflation last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average soared about 230 points in early trading.
According to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve, consumer prices in January were up 2.5% from a year ago. That's a slightly smaller annual increase than the previous month. Stripping out food and energy prices, which bounce around a lot, the core inflation rate was 2.6%. Personal income jumped in January by nearly a full percentage point, thanks in part to the annual cost of living increase in Social Security and other benefits. People spent less of their income last month and socked away a little more. The personal savings rate increased to 4.6%. 5 years ago, before the pandemic hit the U.S., the savings rate was 7%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks are now mixed. This is NPR. Health officials in Texas say they've identified 146 cases of measles. 20 people have been hospitalized. Most of the measles cases are in children who were not vaccinated. One of the children who wasn't vaccinated died this week. Federal health officials have reported a handful of other cases of measles in other states. The first all-female team is headed for the edge of space, apparently sometime this spring. NPR's Amy Held reports the private space company Blue Origin announced the historic lineup, including a pop superstar, on its space tourism rocket flight.
In Fireworks, she sings about shooting across the sky. Now, Katy Perry is set to do it for real, some 62 miles above the Earth. Jeff Bezos' private space company has long leveraged celebrity for a boost in the tourism space race. Also set to ride is his fiancée, Lauren Sanchez, a helicopter pilot, former NASA rocket scientist Aisha Bowe, civil rights champion scientist Amanda Nguyen, filmmaker Carrie Ann Flynn, and CBS News broadcaster Gail King.
I'm so afraid, but I'm also so excited about it.
The six-woman team will be on an autonomous flight, no pilot. 1963 marks the last all-female and solo space flight, when Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space. Amy Held, NPR News.
The Islamic holy month of Ramadan is beginning with the sighting of the crescent moon. The start date can vary by country. The month is celebrated by Muslims worldwide with prayer, fasting, and good works toward others. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, what a grassroots campaign for Americans to not buy anything today might accomplish. But first,
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is here in Washington, D.C. today for his first meeting with President Trump since he became president for the second time.
The two leaders are supposed to sign a preliminary deal to give the U.S. access to Ukraine's natural resources. However, it's not clear that the deal will offer Ukraine future security guarantees, which the country says it needs to protect itself from Russia.
Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR's Joanna Kakissa. She's in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell us about this critical raw materials agreement. What does it include and what does Ukraine get out of it?
Well, Michelle, the idea of swapping revenue from Ukraine's natural resources for continued U.S. support came from Zelensky himself last year as part of his proposal to end the war. Zelensky says the deal on the table today is a framework rather than a final agreement, and it says the U.S. and Ukraine will jointly develop deposits of rare earth metals and critical minerals. These are used in high-tech devices, and also develop deposits of oil and gas. I spoke about all this with Yuri Sak. He is an advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Strategic Industries.
We will need the U.S. to continue to be our strategic partner. So we need to rebuild our country after we end the war, and this agreement is going to work towards that goal.
Now, this agreement establishes a fund to help Ukraine recover should the war end. The fund would be managed by both countries, with Ukraine committing 50% of revenues earned from state-owned natural resources.
Now, this raw materials agreement has gone through many drafts, and you've told us that Zelensky rejected early versions. Why is that?
Well, Zelensky said earlier agreements would have used revenue to pay back aid Ukraine has already received from the U.S. In the current version, the terms are more favorable to Ukraine, and the revenue appears to go to future U.S. investment in Ukraine. Zelensky says he's pushing for security guarantees to be added to any final agreement.
I think, Joanna, now I think people will remember that Trump called Zelensky a dictator last week, and now Trump has moved to warm relations with Russia, which invaded Ukraine. This is very difficult for Zelensky. So are Ukrainians expecting anything positive from this meeting?
Well, Michelle, Ukrainians I spoke to say it is a victory that this meeting is happening at all. Serhiy Fursa, he's a financial consultant who is deputy director of Dragon Capital in Kyiv. He's been following this deal very closely. And he said today's meeting gives Zelensky a chance to talk to Trump in person before Trump meets Russian President Vladimir Putin.
So I do not think that President Zelensky will enjoy this trip personally. He just have to do it. It was told by Queen Victoria, just close your eyes and thinking about England, so close your eyes and thinking about Ukraine.
And he said this is also a crucial opportunity for Zelensky to reset Ukraine's relationship with the Trump administration.
The stakes seem really high for this meeting, Joanna. Are Ukrainians worried it could go poorly?
Yes, I heard that fear from many Ukrainians, including Anna Kolesnik. She's a communications manager in Kyiv.
God help us not to lose a lot, meaning our territories, our raw materials or our mines, and to gain as much benefits from this meeting.
Because, she says, these days it feels like the U.S., Ukraine's most important ally, seems to be threatening to take things away, its friendship, its support, and that leaves Ukraine in a vulnerable position.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're reporting on the Trump administration's foreign policy reversals this week in Ukraine and elsewhere. Today, how these policy shifts could affect Asia. Our co-host Leila Fadel talked with Winston Lord, a former U.S. ambassador to China who was a close aide to the late foreign policymaker Henry Kissinger. Lord is the only surviving American witness of a landmark meeting in 1972 between President Richard Nixon and China's leader Mao Zedong. He had this to say about the present moment.
Well, first of all, it's too early to make definitive judgments after 1 month, but there's no question that there are forces at work here that could lead to a new world order, but it wouldn't be by design. Trump's strategy is an oxymoron. He has no strategy. His goal is not any world order unless it's America bullying other countries and propping up autocrats and eroding democracy. I didn't think it was possible for one person to do such damage to America's position in the world and at home in such a brief time. But I think there's some permanent damage done in terms of America's credibility and position in the world.
Can you break that down for me? When you say it's going to damage U.S. standing in the world and U.S. influence in the world, what does that look like?
All right. We're cutting off aid programs, which is in our national interest, and getting out of all kinds of international institutions like the climate agreement and many others. I could go on for half an hour about all the terrible things that are being done to America and our position in the world.
As you point out, it's been just over a month, but a lot has happened. I mean, just this week, the U.S. joined Russia and North Korea in voting against a resolution condemning Russian aggression in Ukraine. Trump threatened to impose 25% tariffs on the European Union. How do you view this moment?
I think Trump has done more damage to America's position in the world, not even mentioning what he's doing to our democracy at home, in 1 month than decades of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. It's reversing decades of bipartisan foreign policy. It's going to lead to a terribly diminished American role in the world. Just take what's going to happen in Asia if this continues. China and North Korea are delighted at what's going on. If he can sell out Ukraine, he could easily sell out Taiwan.
Your historic trip with Nixon to Beijing changed the fate of Taiwan. Will what's happening today under the Trump administration fundamentally change the U.S. approach?
So it is premature to conclude conclusively what he's going to do about China and Taiwan. On the other hand, you have Rubio and Waltz and other hawks in the administration to protect Taiwan and to be suspicious of China, and many others in the Congress. And so it'd be interesting to see how Trump's instinct to suck up to dictators and with people like Xi, and to forget about commitments and just worry about our own transactional economic interests comes up against the hawks in the administration. But I must say that given the fact that he's made comments on Taiwan taking advantage of us, making the point they're far away, they ought to do more for their own defense, I'd be apprehensive if I were in Taiwan.
What are the things that China might be taking from the U.S. rapprochement with Russia?
Now, those who are apologists for Trump say, well, maybe what he's trying to do is a reverse Nixon-Kissinger, namely to pry Moscow away from Beijing when they've gotten closer and closer.
Trump said he planned to impose next week an extra 10% tariffs on top of the 10% duty he levied at the start of the month on imports from China. How does this impact the economy in China and the economy in the U.S.?
Well, it hurts both, and it hurts the world economy. And here, over time, it's going to lead to greater inflation. China, however, has been preparing for some time, particularly with Trump coming, but even before that, to be less affected by American economic pressures. So their economy would hurt, but they're much better positioned now to ride out American economic retaliation.
How are other U.S. allies in Asia viewing these shifts in longstanding American foreign policy?
With astonishment, and they're appalled. If this trend continues, no one can depend on the United States under Trump to come to their defense. There could be a real drift toward either accommodating China because they don't have America as a deterrent, or going after their own nuclear weapons. It's a disaster for Asia as well as Europe.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to China, Winston Lord. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Back here in the U.S., grassroots organizers, political activists, faith leaders, celebrities say Americans should stop spending today as an act of protest against corporations, billionaires, and both political parties.
A man named John Schwarz from the Chicago area began posting his calls for a 24-hour economic blackout on sites such as Instagram.
On February 28th, do not spend money on anything, not at any major corporation, no Amazon, no Walmart, no banks, no fast food chains. Only support small local businesses and essential needs.
Schwarz did not answer our request for an interview about the organization he set up, the People's Union USA, but he has been posting follow-up videos ever since, like this one.
We, the people, are the economy. Without us, nothing moves. Without us, there is no profit.
The People's Union website says its goal is to, quote, fight for fairness, economic justice, and real systemic change. Social media users and influencers who passed along that message included celebrities such as Bette Midler, Stephen King, and John Leguizamo.
Americus Reed is a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He says just because a planned boycott gets attention on the internet, it doesn't guarantee success.
People will say lots of different things on social media and will report to you lots of different types of outrage. But when it comes down to actually inconveniencing themselves, that's a completely different thing.
Reed says a one-day boycott won't seriously affect corporate bottom lines, but that it could raise awareness.
It's going to require the same kind of kinetic energy and sustained motivation that we saw, you know, with the bus boycotts and other sorts of classic boycotts in history.
Other boycott efforts that have caught traction online include calls to stop shopping at retailers after they scaled back their diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Some faith leaders are also taking aim at Target, which rolled back its longtime DEI efforts. They've asked their congregations to abstain from Target runs during the Christian observance of Lent that starts next week. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how life can change in a second. Writer Hanif Qureshi's first film, 1985's My Beautiful Laundrette, starred Daniel Day-Lewis and won Qureshi an Oscar for Best Screenplay. In 2022, he fell, and when he regained consciousness, his limbs were paralyzed. We'll talk about life before and after the fall. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Panama is in the middle of a complicated migrant crisis. So in the past, hundreds of thousands of migrants crossed the country to make it to the U.S. But with President Trump in office, thousands of migrants are headed the other way. The Trump administration has also flown nearly 300 migrants to the country, and the Panamanian government is trying to figure out what to do with them. NPR's Eder Peralta is traveling toward the Darien Gap from Panama City. Eder, so let's start with that plane load of migrants. What happened?
Hey, so I mean, all of this is an effort by President Trump to speed up deportations. It means the U.S. is now sending Panama and Costa Rica migrants who aren't easy to report from countries like Iran, Eritrea, and Vietnam. And the problem here is that they arrived 2 weeks ago and Panama doesn't seem to know what to do with them. Some are still at a hotel in Panama City. Others who told authorities they wouldn't go back home got sent to a detention facility at the edge of the jungle. Their lawyers have not been able to visit them. They have not been allowed to make phone calls. We went to the hotel and the migrants waved at us from their windows, but we were not allowed in and they were not allowed out. We're now headed toward that jungle facility where we've already been told we will not be allowed in, but we're trying anyway. The lawyers for some of these migrants tell us that they feel like they're living in a kind of purgatory.
Wow. So what's the government saying about this?
You know, they've said that they have run background checks on these migrants and that none of them are criminals. And they have promised to respect their human rights. Yesterday, reporters asked the president, Jose Raul Molino, then why are they being denied access to their lawyers? And he said simply, I don't know. I followed up with him. I asked him, but doesn't this worry you?
Claro, claro, me preocupa.
And what he's saying there is, of course it worries me, but isn't it curious that these poor people would have lawyers in Panama? I asked him what he meant by that, but he cut me off. He said that he wouldn't answer any more questions.
Okay, that's one group of migrants, but now we're hearing about north to south migration. Mm-hmm. So how's that playing out?
More than 2,000 migrants have entered Panama from Costa Rica since Trump took office, and it's messy. The migrants are basically retracing the grueling trail they had already taken north, and they tell us that when they reach the jungle, Panamanian authorities are not letting them through, or they're taking them to a detention camp. So hundreds of them are instead taking small boats south to Colombia. Last week, a little girl drowned after one of these boats capsized. We went to an island off the coast here, and there were dozens of migrants trying to find a way back home. One of them was Marta, who was 59. She only gave us her first name for security reasons, and she says she crossed the jungle twice and then waited for an appointment for months in Mexico City, but when Trump came into office, all those doors closed, and she decided to head back home. And maybe, she said, this was a test from God.
Esto es una vuelta, esto es una prueba. Yo, quizá nosotras mismas no valoramos nuestra ciudad, nuestra vida.
And what she's saying there is maybe we didn't value our past life, and maybe now that we're headed back home, our life will change. I know, she said, that God has something good prepared for us.
That's NPR's Eder Peralta traveling toward the Darien Gap from Panama City. Eder, thank you.
Thank you, A.
It's Friday, and time for StoryCorps. In the 1950s, Alton Yates was just a teenager when he helped send humans into space. He told his daughter, Toni, it all started just after his mother died.
My dad was trying to raise the seven of us by himself, and I knew that as soon as I finished high school, I was going to have to help with taking care of the family.
How did you know he needed your help?
Well, he came home from work, and he rolled cigarettes, he roasted peanuts and put them in little bags, and then he left home immediately to sell those products, and I just couldn't stand to see him continue to do that. There weren't any good-paying jobs just out of high school, so I decided to join the Air Force. And a call had gone out for volunteers to determine the effects of space travel on the human body. So I became one of the human guinea pigs who rode high-speed rocket sleds.
How old were you when you did the first test?
I was 19. When the sled took off, it was almost as if everything in your body was being forced out through your back. And then when it stopped, it was like driving an automobile at 100 miles an hour and running into a stone wall.
But yet you did that 65 times?
I did it more than 65 times. And let me tell you, there was something about the group of volunteers. I remember one, when they took him off the sled, he was like a dish rag. The rest of us saw what happened to him, but we were anxious to get strapped into that seat to conduct the next experiment. We went up to Johnsville, Pennsylvania. They had a huge centrifuge up there. We rode that thing at high speeds, and you had your hand on a little trigger. And the minute you started to black out, your hand would come off the trigger, and that would stop the centrifuge.
Did your dad know what you were doing?
He didn't know initially, but Ebony Magazine published an article that showed pictures of some of these rocket sleds that I had been riding. When my dad got a copy of that magazine, he took that everywhere he went. And I think to make my father proud of me was something that I've always wanted to do. And I was able to do that before he passed away.
The day that man went into space, what was that like for you?
I felt a warmth that came over my body when I heard the countdown. And even to this day, every time there's a liftoff, I think a little piece of me lifts off with each one of those missions.
Alton Yates retired from the U.S. Air Force as a lieutenant colonel. He is also celebrated as a civil rights leader in his hometown of Jacksonville, Florida. We first heard Yates' StoryCorps conversation with his daughter, Toni, in 2014. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Dignity Memorial, pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
Black architects helped shape the modern architecture movement in the United States, but their contributions have long been overlooked.
It's important to save these buildings because of the historical stories they tell, the social stories they tell.
I'm Elsa Chang, the effort to highlight the lives and works of Black architects in America on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump says he's hopeful an agreement to end Russia's war with Ukraine can be reached quickly. Trump was speaking yesterday at the White House after talks with Britain's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. As NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Washington today to meet with Trump and to sign a deal on U.S. access to rare earth minerals.
Zelensky is visiting the White House a little more than a week after Trump called him a dictator and repeated Kremlin talking points, including that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that started the war. Anna Kolesnik, a communications manager in Kyiv, said she's happy the meeting is taking place, but worries it could go poorly.
God help us not to lose a lot, meaning our territories, our raw materials or our mines.
Trump and Zelensky are set to sign a preliminary minerals deal in which the U.S. would get revenue from some of Ukraine's natural resources in exchange for future aid. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
A report from the Israeli military acknowledges security failures ahead of the deadly attack by Hamas militants in southern Israel nearly 17 months ago. The investigation cites what investigators call glaring intelligence failures. This is NPR News. The Justice Department is seeking to dismiss four federal civil rights lawsuits related to alleged discriminatory hiring practices by various police and fire departments in the U.S. The move advances President Trump's anti-DEI agenda, as NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The four cases were brought in the last year of the Biden administration against the cities of Durham, North Carolina, and South Bend, Indiana, as well as Cobb County, Georgia, and the Maryland State Police. The lawsuits had sought to force changes in the defendants' hiring practices, specifically the use of written tests or physical fitness tests that frequently resulted in fewer black and female applicants being hired. Now, Attorney General Pam Bondi has directed the department to dismiss the lawsuits. In a statement, Bondi said American communities deserve firefighters and police officers to be chosen for their skill and dedication to public safety, not to meet DEI quotas. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Blue Origin says its next space launch from Texas will have a celebrity crew of six women. They will include singer Katy Perry, CBS News co-host Gayle King, and Lauren Sanchez, the fiancée of the rocket company's billionaire owner, Jeff Bezos. Sanchez is a helicopter pilot and a former news anchor. The 10-minute flight aboard the new Shepard launch vehicle is slated for sometime in the spring. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. We've reported extensively on how President Trump has spent his first 5 weeks in office trying to expand executive power.
Yeah, his attempt to slash the federal workforce has drawn various lawsuits trying to stop him. Two cases that have just arrived at the Supreme Court could offer some early clues on whether his methods will hold up. They involve some $2 billion in unpaid bills.
NPR's Frank Langford has been tracking the matter. He's with us now. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Michelle.
So we've been covering these cases at NPR. They are about the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Just remind us of the details.
Yeah, Trump officials at USAID, you remember, they cut off funding to thousands of aid recipients. This began January 20th when Trump took office. And the idea was they were going to review contracts to see if they were aligned with Trump's America First agenda. Now, this hit these organizations incredibly hard. They had to furlough people. Some were at the risk of going bankrupt. And so they ended up suing to get paid. Now, a lower court ordered the government to pay up and gave a deadline. Still, the government would not pay. And on Wednesday night, the Trump administration was about to blow through this deadline. So it appeals to the Supreme Court, and Chief Justice John Roberts, he pauses the case, hands the government a temporary victory, and naturally, that got a lot of attention.
So those are the details. Everybody wants to get paid what they are owed. But are there bigger stakes here? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, definitely. You know, these are among the first cases in front of the Supreme Court that involve the president's attempts to expand executive power, like you were just saying. And after all, in these cases, the government had effectively refused to pay money that Congress had already appropriated and the government clearly owes, and that this judge had told it to pay. And the government says in one of its filings that it thinks the lower court exceeded its authority in doing that. And so people are watching very closely now to see how the Supreme Court responds to all of this.
What do legal analysts make of this case?
You know, Michelle, they point out that people's interest really perked up with the Supreme Court's initial ruling in favor of the government. And now the court, of course, it's got a conservative supermajority. Trump appointed three of those justices. Now, Stephen Vladeck, he's a law professor at Georgetown. He's an expert on federal law. And he was writing about this in his Substack. And he thinks Roberts, you know, may have just been trying to give the justices some time to make a reasoned decision rather than one right up against the clock. And Vladeck says, at a superficial level, quote, it's obvious to him that the government should ultimately lose these cases. And that's because the government's, you know, not allowed to just not spend money appropriated by Congress. As we said, I think, often on these shows, under the U.S. system of government, Congress has the power of the purse. However, Trump says, you know, he wants to change the law so that the president can impound money approved by Congress.
So what is the government telling the court right now?
Yeah, the government says it's actually changed its tune a little bit. It says it is committed now to paying what it owes, but it needs to do what it's calling a payment integrity review to make sure that all these invoices are legitimate. But remember, you know, the government did unilaterally halt these payments, and it could have restarted them at any time.
Where's this headed next?
Yeah, the plaintiffs have to file a response to the government today. Legal scholars think the justices are going to move quickly to try to resolve the case because, you know, almost none of these aid organizations have been paid. It's been 5 weeks, and every day their financial situations are only getting a lot worse.
That is NPR's Frank Langford. Frank, thank you.
Happy to do it, Michelle.
The Trump administration is changing how the Department of Transportation gives out money for highways, airports, and public transit. It's prioritizing communities with high birth and marriage rates. Here's Steve Harrison from member station WFAE.
Charlotte, North Carolina is one of the nation's fastest growing cities. To help people get around, it wants to expand its transit system, building new rail lines. It's counting on billions in federal grants.
Please stand clear. Doors are closing. Train is about to move.
Transit advocate Shannon Benz with Sustain Charlotte is worried the city could lose out under the new rule from the U.S. Department of Transportation. That's because Charlotte has a higher than average birth rate, but its marriage rate is lower than the national average.
I think, you know, it's safe to say probably most people who saw that were surprised because that's just so different than what we've ever seen as the priority for USDOT.
Population matters in transportation funding, but he says the birth and marriage rates criteria spelled out are new. Administrations often put their political imprint on how money is spent, says Peter Rogoff, who led the Federal Transit Administration during President Obama's first term. He says former President Biden, for instance, pledged 40% of transit dollars to disadvantaged communities. This new directive, he says, will hurt large cities in blue states.
You look at the lowest fertility rates by major metropolitan area. San Francisco, which has a huge federal project, which is a rail tunnel to extend into downtown San Francisco.
He says low birth rate cities, all Democratic strongholds, get billions of dollars of transit funding. Los Angeles, San Jose, Denver, New York.
It seems not so coincidental to me.
But some conservatives say the new funding directive isn't about hardball politics. It's about a growing concern that the U.S. and other industrialized nations aren't having enough children. The U.S. has fallen below what's considered the replacement rate of 2.1 children for each woman.
Just 1.6 babies per woman on average. We've never had fertility, you know, so low in this country.
That's conservative Brad Wilcox, director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia.
Policymakers, not just in the United States, but across the globe, are scrambling to try to figure out if there are any levers they can pull to help people have the kids they would like to have.
A DOT spokesman said in a statement that strong population growth is a factor in funding, but did not say why marriage rates were added. It's likely a first step to making marriage and fertility a talking point, says conservative Meg Kilgannon. She's with the Family Research Council and wants more policies to promote marriage and child rearing.
The pro-life movement are going to have to shift their thinking about why it is we're not having babies. It's not just because of abortion. They're not even being conceived.
But can the DOT do anything about people not having children or staying single? Attorney Kim Meyer with the Southern Environmental Law Center, who often focuses on transportation, says the memo doesn't make sense, especially the focus on marriage, which she says is
a cultural choice, potentially a religious choice that has absolutely nothing to do with whether you need to get around to work and to the store and take your kid to school.
In the case of Charlotte, it's not clear if transit funding could be secured because of its higher birth rate, or jeopardized because relatively few Charlottians say, "I do." For NPR News, I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte.
This is NPR News.
Of France, the UK, and Ukraine all visit President Trump over tariffs and support for Ukraine. Our weekly roundtable looks at the view from Europe. Next time, here and now.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Protests take many forms. Some take to the streets, some take to the coffee shops. Canadians furious about potential U.S. tariffs are renaming Americanos Canadianos, kind of like freedom fries in the U.S. after France opposed the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Some say the original name for the drink is actually the better diss. American World War II soldiers were supposedly put off by strong Italian espresso, so they watered them down, hence Americanos. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Martinez. The Academy Awards are Sunday night. That means that we are in the thick of Oscar prediction season. Will the 3.5-hour architectural epic, The Brutalist, take home Best Picture? What are Wicked's chances? And what about Anora, last year's Palme d'Or winning film at the Cannes Film Festival? This sounds like a job for NPR's Glenn Weldon, who hosts our Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Glenn, so the telecast itself, I think viewership is probably inching back up since the pandemic really tanked its numbers a few years back.
Yeah, that 2021 broadcast was the least watched in many, many years. Only about 10 million people tuned in, but that makes sense, right? I mean, theaters were closed. If you can't see the movies, you don't care who wins. But the ratings have increased year by year since then, and they're doing what they can to attract more. They're starting the ceremony early at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, like they did last year. They've hired Conan O'Brien to host, and instead of trotting out live performances of the 5 nominated songs, which, let's face it, no one really knows, they've lined up a different series of performers for the night that includes Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande. And the Oscars are being weirdly cagey about what they're going to sing, but it's probably stuff from Wicked, right? I mean, it's not going to be out there doing Smoke on the Water. Doja Cat, Ray, and Queen Latifah will also perform, and it'll all be streaming on Hulu in addition to being broadcast on ABC, so they are chasing that 18 to 45 demo. We'll see if it works.
It's fine. I mean, they've needed to shake up the format for a while now. I know recently they've been introducing the acting categories by having 5 past Oscar winners stand on stage and then gush over the current nominees.
Yeah, it's so cheesy. They call that the Fab Five approach. This year, they're going to try that same approach with non-acting categories, the folks behind the camera. It's a little unclear how it's going to play out, but it seems like you're going to have big stars on stage praising people like the writers and the editors and the costume designers, and it might work, might be fun. Might come off a bit, I'd like to thank the little people, you know, a bit condescending. We'll see. Also look for some acknowledgement of the L.A. fires, which struck such a serious blow to an industry that was only beginning to crawl out from under the pandemic and a series of labor strikes. So maybe a bit less glam this year and a bit more focus on the folks behind the scenes.
All right, let's talk about the big prize, Best Picture. Who do you think is going to take home the big prize?
A month ago, I would have said The Brutalist. It's a solid bet. It's a sweeping, serious epic about a great man with flaws. That is classic Oscars fodder.
Tell me, why is an accomplished foreign architect shoveling coal here in Philadelphia?
I'm afraid it is not so simple.
But Anora really has the wind at its back going into the ceremony. That's a scrappy little film about a Brooklyn sex worker who elopes with the son of a Russian oligarch.
I love my husband.
You do not know this guy.
We are consenting adults.
If you think this is going to be allowed, you're dead wrong.
And where The Brutalist is a bit polarizing, people come out of Anora really digging it. And that matters because that means it's going to benefit from ranked choice voting. So if it's not folks' number one film, it'll score a lot of number 2 and 3 slots. And I think that's going to put it over the top.
Okay, so Anora is what you put your money on, but if you had a vote and could go with your heart, Glenn, what would you choose?
Oh, that's easy. That's Nickel Boys. That's Romel Ross's film based on a book about systemic abuse in a school in the Jim Crow South.
Nana, what is it?
I let you down.
I'm okay. Yeah.
Hell, I let you down.
No.
It uses a first-person perspective. We see the world through the character's eyes, and that could have come off as a really distracting gimmick, but it's used to serve a very moving story. It is such a big, formal swing, and it pays off. And for me, that's the year's outstanding achievement in film, which is ostensibly what the Oscars are about, right?
Yep, that is what the Oscars are all about. We'll see if Sunday night gives us that big surprise. Glenn Weldon from NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. Glenn, thanks.
It's an honor just to be nominated, eh?
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
the slow economic shockwaves of government layoffs.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Current and former workers at the U.S. Agency for International Development are being allowed into USAID headquarters in Washington, D.C. for a second day today for 15 minutes to pack up their belongings. But the federal government's layoffs are being felt across the country, not just in D.C. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer talked to a USAID contractor in Oklahoma about what's happening there.
47-year-old Patricia Gross has worked as an independent government contractor, a gig worker, since 2018. She, her husband, and three young sons live just outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Nonprofits hired her to write applications for federal grants, mostly from USAID and the Agriculture Department. Now the nonprofits are out of work, and so is Gross. So the family is dependent on her husband's salary.
I think, like, right now, we're okay, but, I mean, it's concerning. Last year, I did really well, and we bought a house last summer based on my income, you know, increasing our family income.
Gross says she made about $75,000 last year. She has a side gig helping people write their resumes. She only made about $1,000 doing that in 2024. Now, former resume clients are back. They're federal workers or contractors who are also out of work. Gross says her heart breaks for them, but there's no time to waste.
The advice I've been giving my clients is that people are mourning now, and if you wait a month, everybody is going to start really looking for a job, and there's not that many jobs out there.
Gross herself applied for a few jobs last weekend on LinkedIn, but she got messages back telling her, sorry, the position's been canceled. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The Department of Education removed online applications for consolidations and income-based repayment plans. The studentaid.gov website says the removals are temporary to comply with an appeals court injunction, but it's left student borrowers in the lurch. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the details.
The Department of Education shut down its online application portal for those repayment offerings, but is still providing paper applications for download. At the same time, the Washington Post says the department has instructed loan servicers to stop processing income-based repayment and consolidation applications for at least 3 months. The department says it's complying with an injunction issued last week by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis, halting a Biden-era repayment plan called SAVE, which dramatically reduced or ended repayments for certain borrowers. The appeals court said the Biden administration exceeded its legal authority in setting up that program. Now those enrolled in SAVE may need to apply for other repayment options, but for now they can't. These disruptions come after a pandemic-era repayments pause ended in October. Millions of borrowers have since fallen behind, according to VantageScore, which says they will likely see their credit scores impacted. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
The PCE price index is out this morning. Prices rose 0.3% in January. That's the same as the month before, for an annual inflation rate of 2.5%. That is slightly down from 2.6% measured the month before. And with that, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 252 points. That is 0.6%. The S&P 500 also up 0.6%. NASDAQ's up 0.7%. And investors have been flocking to bonds, pushing the 10-year yield down to 4.23%. That's a big drop from last month when the yield was almost 4.8%. Analysts say people are turning to bonds as a safe place to put their money as concerns about tariffs and the U.S. economic outlook grow.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Amazon yesterday unveiled its first ever quantum computing chip. This follows similar announcements from Microsoft and Google. Research into quantum computing, which could speed up some computing tasks by orders of magnitude, used to happen mostly at academic labs. Private sector investment, though, in quantum computing has grown tenfold in the past decade. Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman looked into why tech firms are spending so much on a technology that hasn't yet actually proven its commercial viability.
Your everyday computer runs on bits. A quantum computer runs on quantum bits, or qubits. And these qubits harness the behavior of subatomic particles, which, says MIT research scientist Andrew McAfee, can make them a pain to work with.
You have to kind of coax them into being, and you've got to wrangle them in these very weird conditions.
For instance, he says MIT has a quantum computing lab on campus that is the coldest place, period.
In other words, down closer to absolute zero than any other place in the universe we know about. And the reason is to kind of convince qubits to hang around a little bit longer and come together in ways that we can harness.
On the most basic level, an ordinary computer bit is like an on-off switch. It either represents one or zero. Qubits work differently, says Heather West, a research manager at IDC.
Qubits rely on quantum properties that allow them to hold the values of zero, one, or any value in between.
She says quantum processors could do calculations that are functionally impossible with today's computers.
That will allow for scientists and engineers in the long run to be able to solve complex problems that have eluded them.
Quantum computers could speed up things like drug discovery, material science, or the pricing of risk in the insurance industry. But Amy Webb, CEO of Future Today Institute, says it could take years to get there.
This is a field that really has a very long horizon ahead of it in terms of research and development, scaling, and getting these concepts into market.
And that can be tricky for companies seeking investor dollars.
Because investors have ever-shortening expectations for when they're going to see a return.
But quantum computing is likely to become so valuable, says Andrew McAfee of MIT, it makes sense for tech firms to spend on it now, at least the firms with deep enough pockets.
That allows them to extend their timeline beyond, you know, next quarter or what we're going to put in the annual report next year.
Because McAfee says for whoever manages to scale quantum computing, the returns will be there, eventually. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sri Benishwar with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.